an official government-approved and funded archaeological survey was conducted some 30-odd years ago. One of my friends was involved, Noel Hilliam, founder of the Dargaville Museum.
Yes.
And an inveterate explorer of ancient sites. He's a qualified, or was, I should say, he died about a year ago, was a qualified marine archaeologist, so he was there officially as a representation of Heritage New Zealand, as it was then. So for several weeks, they surveyed the site, took samples of pieces of wood, charred wood and that sort of thing, and did radiocarbon dating tests. Then, suddenly, an embargo was put on the report, and it took my friend Gary Cook a repeated effort to finally, under the Official Information Act, to finally get them to release it. But the one that was released had been redacted. Parts had been struck out.
Blacked out.
Including, critically, a few of the radiocarbon dates. Radiocarbon dates cited officially and in the released report talked about 900 AD. But according to Noel, there was other radiocarbon dates went back as far as 2225 BC.
Yes.
And that's a stunning date. That means that there is an almost certainty that there were people living here 4,000 plus years ago.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. In the studio this morning, I have John Dudley Aldworth. He has been living in New Zealand for the last 40 years. And living here, he has found many very, very interesting things about our ancient history. And that you will not find this in the books that we have that are part of the education system in New Zealand. And so John has decided to look back deeply into it because he actually comes from a journalist or newspaper background. And he feels intuitively that there is a greater story, and in his tours around New Zealand he has met other people, particularly Maori, who have told him what they have heard from their great-great-grandparents. And so John has come to the studio today to be able to share his profound story of his book Forbidden History. So kia ora, John.
Kia ora. Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, John, a friend of mine showed me your book about a year ago, and I took a photograph of your name and phone number, and it's taken me a while to get round to getting on that telephone and tracking you. I think your email's there too. And so you came to New Zealand 40 years ago. Prior to that, what were you doing?
I was a journalist in Britain. In fact, I'd known working at nothing else, pretty much apart from a stint as a lorry driver for a while. But I worked on various newspapers, including the Daily Mail and a couple of evening papers in Britain. And for health reasons, brought my family to New Zealand 40 years ago, which proved successful. My daughter lived, whereas she hadn't been given long to live in the UK.
And you went to Gisborne, is that right?
Yeah, I came to Gisborne, worked on the Gisborne Herald for a start, then moved to Wellington, worked for the government for a while in PR, and also worked on both the Dominion and the Evening Post, as they then were in Wellington. Then I went to Australia for 3 years, worked on the West Australian there, edited a magazine, then came back to New Zealand and found a berth on the Waikato Times. And I've lived in Hamilton pretty much since.
So you've got a very good background in how information is dispensed. And of course, we're in a transition now from the written word on paper to the digitalized word.
Mm-hmm.
And we can get information out far more faster. And we can edit on the run now with the way technology is moving. And in this whole process, though, you've been able to touch in on New Zealand. And have a look at the history of the country.
Yes, well, I have. The interesting thing about that is, of course, that the 19th century European historians and some of the Maori historians all talked about something which has become virtually politically incorrect today, and that is the fact that there were different peoples living here before the Maori or the Polynesians came to this country. And today, that is not taught in our schools, it's not taught in our universities, but if it is true that there were other people here, then they are a real and genuine part of our history. And as my book seeks to show, they have their descendants still here among us. They're living today. And the story of at least two of them is told in my book. A lady who is a campaigner for her Patupairehe people. She's the last tribe of the Patupairehe who were fair-skinned, fair-haired, and usually had red hair. And they lived in large numbers in this country from about the year, or just before Christ was born, right through until today. There's still a small tribe of them living at Taumarunui.
And one of the markers to be able to clarify this is now with DNA analysis. And this is a key component in this, isn't it?
It is. Her name is Monica Matamua. She's now 85, I think. Pretty much retired. Thankfully, she was able to get some piece of her land back, which belonged to her people originally. So she settled herself on that with her family. But yes, about 4 years ago, she had a DNA test. National Geographic had a project called Genome Project, and she had her DNA tested, and it was assessed rigorously under that project, and it was found that she had nearly 40% Mediterranean origin, 12% European, and from memory only about 14% Oceanic, which is the Maori or Polynesian component. She is, of course, descended from people who had intermarried with Maori people, which brings up an important point that Maori themselves, at least in part, are descended from the original inhabitants of this country themselves. Not all of them necessarily, but certainly some of them. And I've been astonished that my book, which doesn't hold back on saying that there were people here before the Maori, has been bought well by Maori people who are delighted to know that they have a longer whakapapa than they thought they had.
Yes. Yes, this is very interesting from that standpoint, is that when we go back through the past, I mean, there's all sorts of stories. I've had Gary Cook. I've interviewed Gary Cook.
Right, a friend of mine.
Yes, and I went to a talk by Barry Brailsford up on the island of Kauai.
Right.
Way back in the year 2000. And there are historians in New Zealand, I mean, the government would say amateur historians, but they have also backed into a lot of, shall we say, Maori people who have been able to tell what their ancestors said, because the early game plan was the ancestors told stories about where they came from. I'll give you an instance. When the missionaries got to Hawaii, they asked the Hawaiians, oh, where did you come from? And the Hawaiians pointed to the Pleiades, which is Matariki. And so, again, that historical fact has been wiped from the record. And now when Maori tell of the ancestors and the ancestors tell of fantastic stories, that too has been wiped off the record. So could you just explain a little more about some of these deeper intricacies of how these peoples came to Aotearoa, New Zealand?
Gladly. You have to take yourself back to a time, firstly, 2,000 to 3,000 years ago. Great upheaval in the Middle East. And according to Monica Matamua, her people lived in part of the Persian Empire in the Middle East. There was huge war. Persia went to war with Greece and others. And they formed a company that was seeking a place to live in peace. So they left the Middle East, stopped at various places en route, arguably Africa, India, and certainly Borneo, and then South America. But she says that at each and every place they stopped off, they encountered people who sooner or later wanted to go to war against them or against somebody else. And so they sailed on and, in her story, eventually reached New Zealand some centuries before Jesus Christ was born. Still with this great desire to live in peace. And despite other people's coming, the first sort of Polynesians were the Waitaha people, the Waitaha Nation, who lived in this country, according to their recently deceased Paramount Chief, George Connolly, who otherwise known as Hori Manuka Manuka Kapenga, who was a Upoko Araki High Chief of the Waitaha people. And he said his people landed in New Zealand 580 AD. So you had the Patupairehe here, then you have the Waitaha. There were earlier people, but we won't talk about that. It gets confusing. So when the Waitaha came, they also had the desire to live in peace. And although there were three branches of the Patupairehe people, very fair ones, red-haired ones who were a bit swarthier, and brown ones, three races within them, and then the Waitaha, who were a mixture of people who came from, again, from the Middle East, according to George, from Egypt, down through South America, and intermarried with the Melanesian people they encountered as they came down through the islands from Easter Island down to New Zealand. So he would maintain that that is the origin of all the Polynesian people, a mixture between the Melanesians and Mediterranean European people. At any rate, the fascinating fact is in New Zealand they lived for 1,300 years without war or conflict. And as far as I know, Tim, this is the only country in the world which can lay claim in its history to having had an experience like that.
Well, the person who I visited and who had that book, that was the first thing that she said. She said, New Zealand had peace for 1,300 years. Mm. And for people to live in peace for that long, it's very extremely special.
Indeed. And we owe it to ourselves, if that is the history of this country, to find out how it was achieved. Because as far as I know, it's unique to New Zealand. And what a wonderful thing for New Zealand to be able to say, this is the place of peace. Poinamo, the word for the South Island, actually means that, the waters of peace. And it was a tradition that held for a long time until warrior people came to this country and began to attack. And from that you get the history of the warfare that the Maori engaged in, first with the already existing people who were here, and then intertribal warfare among themselves. But the peace thing is so important.
Well, I agree, because we can leapfrog right through to 1986-87, when New Zealand became the first country on Earth, or major country, to become nuclear-free.
Yeah.
This was another step forward.
That's right.
Harmonizing of souls so that we can actually live together as a humanity. Yeah.
That's right. We may have very different views, may have different religious views, but the important thing for our self-survival, all of us, is to live in peace. Nothing can be built out of war that is worth having. So there we are. That's who they were. Now, you say, you ask, how did they live in peace? Well, I talked to Monica deeply about that and to George, and he said, look, it's not as though there wouldn't be arguments in the families. It's not as though people wouldn't have differences of opinion. It isn't as though there might be a fistfight occasionally. But they stopped at that. They didn't go on. And interestingly, talking about the Moriori people who were considered extinct until Michael King published his book about the Moriori, maintaining that they were still alive. And Sorry, I'll digress. I'll get back to the peace point in a minute. But where all this started for me was about 15 years ago. I was working on a little weekly newspaper in the Waikato and was approached by a gentleman who explained that he was the Moriori chief in the Waikato, which sort of took me aback.
Yes.
I didn't even know there were any Moriori or ever had been in the Waikato. But his name is Philip Ranga, and he lives at Raglan. And he said, all this land from here to Tauranga was once ours. And if you look at a very old British Admiralty map, drawn up in the very early days of British presence here, it, in large capital letters, says Ranga right across the centre of the North Island from Waikato to Blair. It was their territory. However, they had been conquered and subdued and almost decimated by incoming Maori tribes. So I published a story in the paper saying this was so, and immediately got challenged by some Maori people. And I said, well, okay, let's put this to the test. We'll speak to Professor Tom Roa at the Waikato University.
Tom?
Tom Roa, R-O-A.
Mm-hmm.
Of the Maori department at Waikato Uni. And he said, oh, yes, it's very true. There were people here before we came. Just to emphasize that point, in the official history of the Tainui Iwi, the big tribe, it is stated that they carried out a campaign, having landed in the Waikato, of driving out and killing the indigenous people that they found. And they actually report in that history, there came a day when there was a great battle south of Tiamutu where they wiped out the last of the indigenous people who lived in the Waikato. Getting back to the Moriori, as everybody knows now, I think, they lived and thankfully still do live in small numbers on the Chatham Islands.
Right.
And about 300 to 400 years ago, there was a chief there who underwent a sort of religious conversion, and he determined that that tribe was going to now live at peace, the Moriori on the Chathams. They had been warriors up until then. In fact, it's thought that they drove out and killed the previous people who lived on the Chathams, who may well have been the Waitaha. Be that as it may, this chief had a sort of vision or word from God that peace was the thing to do. They destroyed all their weapons and for 200 to 300 years lived in peace until two Maori tribes dispossessed from their land in Taranaki in the 19th century, hired a ship in Wellington, sailed down to the Chathams and proceeded to attack and kill the Moriori there. And the pathetic thing is, the Moriori stood on the beach and waved branches to welcome them.
Turapraha.
Yeah.
Was the chief.
That's right.
Yes, well,
so there, Tim, is the proof that this peace thing, this belief in peace and the importance of it, was widespread in New Zealand for a long period of time.
Well, aroha, aroha, aloha in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And I changed a couple of letters in the Hawaiian alphabet. The missionaries did that when they came to Hawaii a couple of hundred years ago.
That's right.
But aloha and aroha essentially follow the same intent.
Yeah.
And it is love.
That's right.
And it is a very powerful, powerful love. So this is a thing that also we need to be able to fall back on as aroha, because in many cases, revenge and utu got in the way of this thing called, this magnificent thing called love.
That's right.
And so we must remember this too. And in all our discussions, we must always hold love as the focus for us to be able to then communicate and find out what our differences are and resolve and heal the break or the division between us.
That's true, and really the summation of later New Zealand history is that making of the peace between incoming Europeans and others on one hand and the Maori people on the other. And, of course, it's had its ups and downs. It has been far from the perfect process, but it's certainly better now than it was then. Unfortunately, that process has taken place at the expense of the truth that there were people here before the Maori, and they have been left out. That's why my book goes to bat for them to some extent, because they were never a party to the Treaty of Waitangi. They have not been recognised under the Treaty of Waitangi, yet they are the true Tangata Whanau, the true sons of the soil. And actually, in the book Takitimu, the Ngāti
Kahanunu
tribe,
yes,
record in their history, the book's written by a gentleman called J.H. Mitchell, he says that when they first came to their lands around Hawke's Bay and over toward Taupo and on the plateau, they were received by people who were already living here. He said, without that, we couldn't have survived. Yet, that same tribe turned on those people who'd welcomed them as hosts and began to slaughter them. And I detail some of that those dreadful massacres that took place. For example, if you drive over the desert road beneath Mount Tongariro, you will see a smaller cone-shaped hill, and it's called Pukekai Kiori, the Hill of the Meal of Rats. And there, according to Monica, 2,000 of her people were slaughtered by the tribe Tufonitoa. Again, comparatively recently, in 1820, in Taumarunui, which was then a settlement of largely Patupairehe people, numbering more than 1,000 or two, there came a warrior party composed of Maniapoto and other tribes and descended without warning on them, lined several hundred of them up along the banks of the Ongarue River at its confluence with the
Whanganui,
thank you, and proceeded to chop them up for dinner. Now, that is not commemorated there. I think it should be, because if you don't remember the terrible things that happened, you're in danger of one day possibly allowing them to be repeated. Same as the murder of Christian missionaries and that sort of thing is commemorated elsewhere. Not to glorify that, it's nothing that anybody would want to glorify, but to remember it, lest we make the same mistake again. That's why we have our Anzac Day here, of course, for the same reason.
Yes, well, when we look at the history of a human race, it's all been about, in many ways, disconnection from family, from community, from people. It's been division and the taking of life, the control of land, the control of everything. And we're at a stage now on the planet at the moment, John, that we have to come together. And I still believe in the grand reconciliation of the human race as the only way we can break out of this trajectory that we have got ourselves into.
Right. We could talk a lot about how that might come about. We don't have a good record as the human race of being able to do it, do we? But let me say something about the Maori people. You mentioned family unity and so on. I know Maori people. I was married to a Maori lady for several years. I have children who walk in both the European and the Maori worlds. And I have a very soft heart for them. The Araha part of the Maori culture came from the people who lived before. In fact, much of what the best part of Maori people came from that. A lot of their art, craft, culture, fishing nets and stuff like that were learned from the earlier people who had a different language. For example, in ancient New Zealand language, heaven is not rangi, but raki. And while Maori call the eel tuna, it's called kariki, I think, if I remember rightly, in the older language. So you have the traces of this older language, this older culture there. And of course, when Maori conquered a tribe of these earlier people, to put it in their words, they ate them up. They ate up all that they were, their land, their being, their culture, their knowledge. Everything became that of the conquering tribe, so that a lot of the best in Maori was from these earlier people. The cannibalism, the warfare, that came from the Melanesian connection. If you go to Papua New Guinea, the Solomons, and you dig in that, you'll find that was their culture until quite recently. They too have changed, and much for the better. But that's where it came from. And so there was a clash of cultures anciently in New Zealand. I believe it would be hugely helpful to all New Zealanders, especially those who have come as immigrants recently, to have a knowledge of our history, because out of it did come peace, out of it did come reconciliation. And that's part of the book, the tremendous impact the preaching of the gospel of Jesus Christ had in the 19th century. If you like, I can go into that a little.
Well, there were things that were taken. Yep, change the context, please.
Okay.
Yep.
What happened was this. First of all, this is another unique thing to New Zealand. In all of Christian history over the last 2,000 years, there is only one country which had the highest proportion per head of population of people who actually believe God sufficiently to get into deep Bible study every week. That country was New Zealand in around the year 1830, where more than 60% of the then 180,000 population were attending regular weekly Bible studies. And Maori actually took Christianity to themselves and spread it around the tribes themselves. It interesting stories told of the first white missionary who plodded over the hills from Hawke's Bay to get into Poverty Bay. And when he arrived there, he found that there was a hall like a meeting house where they were having church. They were singing hymns, they were praying, and they had a Bible in Maori.
Whew, how did they get that Bible translated from English into Maori?
Well, that was the work of the very early missionaries. And the interesting story told in connection with Poverty Bay, that you'll recall Hongi Hika had a campaign right down the east coast and round into Poverty Bay because he'd got the muskets. And so he went to sort of shoot and clean up the tribes on the way through. Pathetically, when he got to the Ngāti Porou people in Poverty Bay, they cut reeds out of the bed and tried to pretend they were rifles to hold them off. Of course, they couldn't. So they were terribly massacred. A number of Ngāti Porou were kept as slaves, sadly, to provide rations on the journey back, but some of them survived that, and then the old chief there underwent a change of heart. He was now hearing the preaching of Marsden and people like that, early missionaries, felt Araha come into his heart. I should care for these people. So both he and they were having Bible studies up in Northland there, and he was so moved, he decided, he said, I'll set you free. He said, you go back to Poverty Bay. And of course, they took with them one of the first copies of the Bible translated into Maori.
Yes, because I understand that T.W. Ratana also had a conversion in Whanganui.
Yeah.
And his conversion was such that if you go to that church now, there's a sign at the gate that this is the place where T.W. Ratana and his Christian understanding obliterated Tolhungaism, because the Tolhungas at that particular stage, instead of as medicine men or shaman, they had actually shifted to the darker side of their art form. They weren't bringing through the light. They were not in many ways doing their best to bring through the good. What they did is they used their art as a dark form. They went to the dark side.
That's very true. They actually used their form to protect land. Once it had been won by a chief, they would then proceed to place tapus on it, which were punishable by death. Breach of a tapu, punishable by death.
Spells.
To protect
spells.
The land owned by the chief. The yes. Other thing they did was prophesy, and in this case you have sort of prophets and prophetesses and all, but very much on the dark side. They would induce the medium of perhaps an unborn or aborted child And that powerful spirit would be used to conjure up prophecies and to whip the war party into a frenzy before they took off to attack somebody.
Well, there is that side of the whole thing, John. Yeah. And so what I'd like to see we can do is a lot of this information has been curtailed. It's been obliterated. And I know that I spent some time in Australia, living in Australia, and there, north of Sydney is a place called Gosford, and there's some caves in there with hieroglyphics that have been carved into the walls. And that information has been sort of suppressed. And all along the coastline, right up as far as Cairns, they've found all sorts of ancient burial places or ancient places where people have lived. That's in Australia, and all that has either been destroyed and suppressed. Now, we go to the Waipua Forest, where Tana Mahuta, the great kauri, is and lives. In there, there is an area that the Department of Conservation knows is a very ancient site. Can you speak to that, please?
Surely. That actually is probably one of the major bones of contention in this whole issue, that those who have explored it have found the remains there of what they say is effectively a stone city. There are some several kilometers of paved stone roads. There are heaps of stone ruins, which it is thought were once sort of conical houses. There are the remains of a temple and an altar. And this supported a population of some thousands. There is secondary bush growth, but of course originally it would have been kauri forest. Now for quite a wide swathe, there is no kauri forest there because it had been cleared. One of the roads runs down to the sea. Now, the story is this, that this was found by various people, and interest was aroused in exploring it, and an official government-approved and funded archaeological survey was conducted some 30-odd years ago. One of my friends was involved, Noel Hilliam, founder of the Dargaville Museum.
Yes.
And an inveterate explorer of ancient sites. He's a qualified, or was, I should say, he died about a year ago, was a qualified marine archaeologist, so he was there officially as a representation of Heritage New Zealand, as it was then. So for several weeks, they surveyed the site, took samples of pieces of wood, charred wood and that sort of thing, and did radiocarbon dating tests. Then suddenly, an embargo was put on the report, and it took my friend Gary Cook a repeated effort to finally, under the Official Information Act, to finally get them to release it. But the one that was released had been redacted. Parts had been struck out.
Blacked out.
Including, critically, a few of the radiocarbon dates. Radiocarbon dates cited officially and in the released report talked about 900 AD. But according to Noel, there was other radiocarbon dates went back as far as 2225 BC.
Yes.
And that's a stunning date. That means that there is an almost certainty that there were people living here 4,000 plus years ago. Other proof for that is that in the late 19th century, they were digging up a street in Auckland in order to put new mains down or something or other. Had to go very deep. They went through the volcanic ash deposit, right through that, and well underneath that, they found a tree stump which had been adzed, and the adz was there too, a stone adz. And so that predates a very early eruption by volcanoes in Auckland. And that was assessed at around the same period. That would be around 4,000 years ago that tree was cut. There is other evidence confirming this. But the problem is, as you mentioned earlier, this has been suppressed. An embargo is still in force, preventing any further examination of the stone city in Waipao Forest. In fact, there are 105 embargoes in place, preventing any information about 105 archaeological sites in New Zealand reaching the public. I know that because there was a parliamentary question to the Minister of Conservation, probably about 10 or 15 years ago now, and that was the answer he gave. And this embargo was in place, he explained, because it was felt that this information was better withheld from New Zealanders. Now, of course, I'm a journalist. My motto is publish and be damned, you know. It's the truth there, let's get it out. Because if we haven't got the truth, if we do suppress the truth, then it's only one step from there to effectively promulgating and persuading people to believe a lie. And unfortunately, that is what has happened. The lie, which is there for political purposes, is to say that there were nobody here of a different race before the Maori. But that just simply isn't true. Why? Because you ask any Maori person who's reasonably educated, understands something of his history, her history, and they will tell you that they know very well there were people here before they came. You can stop almost any of them, and they will admit that. They actually take a pride in it, because we come from all of that. Now, I'm British. In school there, I learned that the British, the English, 57 varieties, you know, we're a mongrel race, but we're the product of all the different peoples who lived in, conquered, or came to Britain. You know, from ancient Celts.
There's Vikings. There's
Romans. Yeah. There was Normans.
Picts.
Germans.
Jutes.
Picts, Jutes,
Saxons.
Angles.
Saxons.
I'm Anglo-Saxon. And the thing we learned out of that was this, that the British character at its best, because it's got bad sides too, of course. I've got a few blots on my family escutcheon. Won't go into those. But leaving aside the blots on the escutcheon, the good side of it, the noble side of it, the better than average side of it, was a product of the cultures mixing of all those people.
Yes.
And today, if somebody stumbles across an archaeological site in Britain, it's news. It's great news. It's good news. Everybody gets in. Let's find out what it was.
Who we are.
Who was there? Why were they there? What did they do? There's no attempt to cover it up.
Mm.
It's celebrated, in fact. And that's what I'd like to see in New Zealand. Doesn't it remove that sense of impermanence, that you're sort of in a new land and nobody's been here very long and we haven't got a depth of culture, but we have, if we want to learn our history.
I hear you very clearly. I'm speaking with John Aldworth on his book Forbidden History, and you can track him on forbiddenhistory.co.nz. forbiddenhistory.co.nz. Yes, I hear you very clearly, John. I mean, put 100 academics into a room and then put the Pyramid of Cheops on the Giza Plateau in Egypt as the study for all these intellectuals and let them look at that and see the mathematics and geometry and the perfection and the impeccability and the way these 2.5 million stones were put together and slotted together, they would end up having a hemorrhage because they'd realize that these people who put these pyramids up are far more adept at the higher knowledge than they are today.
That's very true. Very true, Tim. You see, you have to ask the question, why is there a desire to suppress the truth about New Zealand's hidden past? The answer's various. Partly it's political, because it's thought that it would upset Maori people if it was promulgated that they weren't the first. But the people who hold that forget that the purpose of the Treaty of Waitangi was to make us all one. We were to become one people under the treaty, one law for all people. And if there was help, if there was encouragement needed, it was to be for all people. And I personally am all in favour of helping Maori people in areas, we say, like Northland, the East Coast, elsewhere, where they need some economic encouragement. I think they should be given it because they are New Zealanders, not because they are Maori. Though, of course, one doesn't wish them to stop being Maori. You understand what I'm saying? So to promise them things, control of rivers or something, in their name, or name a mountain after them because allegedly they were here first, doesn't cut it. It doesn't really help them. But the second reason why this is so, and this turns to the academic scientific argument, is because worldwide science is still stuck between a rock and a hard place, trying to maintain that anciently, and when anciently we're talking 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago, there was no great traffic around the world. Ships didn't sail from the northern hemisphere down into the southern hemisphere. People from Egypt and the Middle East didn't get to Australia, didn't get to South America, didn't get to New Zealand. But as you just pointed out, in Australia and in New Zealand and in South America, there's heaps of evidence that they did. A huge number of artifacts have been found. Rock inscriptions. Plants have been transported from one side of the world to the other. But all of this is dismissed by academics because they say, oh, that's diffusionism. And diffusionism, beginning with D, is a very dirty word in their vocabulary. You mustn't have diffusionism. Why? Because supposedly we evolved, we all evolved, and people being separated by long distances around the world evolved separately. So their theory is that people crawled out of caves, both in the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere, and somehow, amazingly, learned to grow the same sort of crops, weave the same sort of cloth, build the same sort of monuments, temples, pyramids, etc., all without contact with each other, which I find an absolute absurdity.
Well, they have found some mummies, Egyptian mummies, and they've found cocaine.
That's right.
In their DNA or in their whatever remains. So the cocaine only comes from South America.
That's right.
So there's another, goes on and on and on. And so listeners, please, go up on YouTube, search under words that look at the past, go into ancient archaeology, look into the past. It's imperative. And there's a very good video, Skeletons in the Cupboard.
Yep.
Now that gives a very good understanding and you actually have an opportunity to listen to and see Monica Matumua.
Yes.
Because you can see from her eyes and her hair that she is very, very different. Now, can I just jump back? I used to hear the term Waka Blonde. Now, I lived in a place called Matamata, which is not far from Tauranga on the Waikato side. I was actually born in ancient Moriori territory. But Rotorua was just up the road, 40 k's. And they used to talk about Waka Blondes, and I thought it was that the Maoris were jumping into the water with sulfur, and the sulfur caused their hair to go blondish, because I know that in swimming pools when they used to put...
Peroxide, perhaps?
Yeah, peroxide.
Chlorine.
Chlorine, okay. I thought it was like chlorine in the water, the sulfur, and that's why it made your hair go. But it wasn't until very recently, in the last 25 years that I've heard about the whole new impetus of information about other peoples being in this whole equation of who came to New Zealand and who are in New Zealand now as a descendant of these people. And so the whole Waka Blonde has got a different meaning to me now.
I'm glad of that. There's actually a photograph in my book, Forbidden History, and there is a website, Forbidden History. You can look at that.
And you can tell us now, John.
Okay. And if you contact me, I'll be happy to sell you a book. It is available in some libraries, some bookshops, but if in doubt, look at Forbidden History or put my name simply in the Google search line, Aldworth, and forbidden history. It'll come up for you. And if you contact me, I'm happy to sell you one. But in there is a picture of Walker Blondes. And the interesting thing is this was taken mid-19th century. One of them is wearing glasses. They are wearing glasses. But they're as European as you'd find many New Zealanders are European in terms of their appearance. And obviously they're intelligent people. And the early European settlers here, I mean the latter-day ones, recognize these people as different. There are a lot of photographs that show Maori tribes or families, and you'll see that some of them are essentially white. Now, I don't want to be labeled a racist. I'm not a racist. My wife is a Filipino. We accommodate students in our home. Right at the moment, we have an Egyptian and a Pakistani staying with us. I'm not opposed to people of different color, different race, different religion at all. But the facts of history are the facts of history. And it shouldn't be offensive to anybody if it is found that a race of essentially white or fair-skinned people, along with some who were darker and some who were brown, were here long before the Maori. It isn't a matter of the color of your skin. It's a matter of history as fact. So yes, there were indeed Walker Blondes. And for men who'd come from another country and didn't have a wife or family, I'm sure they were really wanted to get to know them. Along with getting to know a lot of the Maori ladies as well, no doubt.
Yeah, so John, you printed that book some years ago. What have you learned since? I'm sure you would have had an influx of information that supports you, but have there been any new insights as a result, particularly the fact that we're the forensics and now we're getting fairly focused on this? There's the Otua Tower Stonefields here in Mangere, yep, not far from the airport, that go back, we don't know how far back, but they're in a very prominent place under Mangere, Mount Mangere, and it's only a short paddle and a waka, a canoe, to the Manukau heads, and it's open sea to Australia or all up the coast towards Asia and the Pacifica.
The ancient peoples preferred to live by the water. In fact, the name Waitaha means beside the water. They did that because they wanted to fish. They did that because they wanted to sail boats of some description out to sea, and they were a gardening, farming people. I spent much of my childhood in Lancashire, and there, of course, you see dry stone walls all over the hills. They're not, no cement. It's a great art in stacking stone upon stone.
Certainly.
And they last for hundreds of years.
Yes.
And the stone walls here in Auckland and further north and in other places are not, we understand, the work of Maori people. They predate that. And of course, they've been adopted and taken over by Maori people. But they are a precious historical treasure that definitely needs to be preserved. They need to be properly examined. And we need, if I may say so, a story. When we come to an archaeological site here in New Zealand or elsewhere in the world, it's no good just having a set of scientific measurements, though they're useful, unless we can tell the story of the people who built that archaeological remains, temple, site, walls, whatever it is, and explain who they were and where they fit into the picture. The problem with archaeology worldwide is they've got the facts, but in most cases they haven't got the story. And you ask what I discovered since. I've discovered a story that fits the facts. I'm not going to tell you too much about it, but suffice to say, as far as New Zealand's concerned, it's a story about the people who came here more than 4,000 years ago and the person who led here. And it's actually ancient history recorded in a book.
Well, Noel Hillier mentions that there's a cave or cave complex up north, where they found a huge amount of skeletons.
Yes.
And a gigantic number. And these skeletons were eventually taken away and crushed or and turned to fertilizer by the Europeans down in Onehunga. Can you just, I mean, this is horrendous that, that we get rid of the past. When I say the word get rid of, there's nothing sacred.
It should be sacred. If you find human remains, then, I don't know, there's a deep instinct in me. I was exploring in the Waitomo area near the caves once, and just walking, I'd been dipped through the caves. It was long before I understood any of this stuff about ancient history. And I'm wandering through the bush, and there's a sort of bit of a cliff face and a ledge on it, and there is a skull. Now, I didn't touch it. I didn't go near it. I thought, do I uplift it? Do I go and tell somebody about it? And I thought, no, somebody has placed the skull there, and in their view, that's where it should be, and that's where I'm going to leave it. So I would never have treated human remains with anything but utter respect. To get back to Noel Hilliam, his great-grandparents, I think, were among the first who took up land in the area near Dargaville. And at the time, Noel says, there were no Maori or other peoples living there. So it was unused land, which is why the government parceled it out for farms. On the land around there, there are numerous caves. It's a sort of sandstone, but the water seeps in and forms underground caves. There were two or three on the farm that he then had, and in them, yes, he found skeletons and skulls. He believes they were of the Turihu people, which is a branch of the Patapaianehi people, and he had a sample from such a skull was taken to Britain by a geneticist who tested their DNA and came up with a match, saying that they were most like the Welsh that lived 3,500 years ago. He also was in touch with a forensic reconstruction expert, the sort of person who models a face in plastic materials on the base of a skull. And that was done to two of these skulls. And, of course, this is partly conjectural. Let's admit it. But what the artist came up with was a fair, flaxen-haired woman of a very blonde, fair-skinned nature, and with the second skull, a swarthier, darker, Mediterranean-type man. And, of course, that sparked, when he publicized that a few months before his death, that caused a real upset in the academic and media world. In fact, the Heritage New Zealand threatened to prosecute him. The editor of the Northern Advocate was soundly rebuked for having published the story about this wonderful archaeological find without having checked reputable, accredited archaeologists and historians for their say on it. And sadly, it's come to the point now where amateurs who discover archaeological evidence in this country are A, forbidden from examining it themselves. It is referred to the local Maori tribe, whose elders decide what shall happen to it. And secondly, they are forbidden by law, under punishment of various kinds, from touching or disturbing it. Now, I think this has got itself into a ludicrous situation in this country. How on earth, then, can anybody find anything from our past without getting into trouble? Why is it that only one sector of society is allowed to decide what shall happen to archaeological remains, excluding the vast majority of us.
And then control the narrative.
Yes.
Yes.
And, you know, I'll be blunt, I'll say it, that the reason is to engineer a society which is different from the one we've got. Now, there may be good reason to have a better society than what we've got. I don't have an argument with that. But let's not do it at the expense of the truth. Let's keep a history because, you know, history is, and an understanding of it, helps to prevent us making the mistakes that have been done in the past. Or alternatively, more positively, it gives us something to look back to that we can look up to and say, well, we'd like to be like those people. Either way, you miss out if the evidence is deliberately buried and suppressed.
So true, so true. This is the challenge of the now, from now on. Forbidden history. Thank you, John. Thank you so much for coming and sharing. Cheers, brother.
Thank you very much indeed for having me. And, you know, I do this in a spirit of peace and love for all people. I know that my own education in Britain gave me a sense of pride and a sense of belonging, as in history we reviewed all different peoples that eventually made up the British people. And I'd like to see that happen in New Zealand, that everybody who comes here and lives here could see, well, I'm a part of a process which began with people coming here 4,000 years ago. And as you pointed out, Tim, they were intelligent, technically proficient people. They weren't, you know, cavemen who just crawled out of the cave. They weren't just hunter-gatherers. They were something different. And the sad truth is that often various pockets of mankind have deteriorated from what they once were. We're not evolving to get better. In many ways, we're still going backwards.
This is a regrettable thing, yes. Thank you, John. Thank you.
You're most welcome.
Well, we've got a lot of good information out there, John.
That was John Dudley Aldworth. John Aldworth speaking about his book, Forbidden History, a 240-page quality soft cover book on gloss stock, described as a gripping read by those who have previewed it. And it's available at some bookshops, but you can also get him at 17 Clark Place, Hillcrest, Hamilton, 3216. And phone number 07-856-4655. And phone number 07-856-4655. $40. And John's email is john.aldworth, A-L-D-W-O-R-T-H, at hotmail.com. John.aldworth, A-L-D-W-O-R-T-H, at hotmail.com. And don't forget YouTube, New Zealand Skeletons in the Cupboard, by Gabby Plum and Peter Marsh. Decide to network. Use every letter you write, every conversation you have, every meeting you attend, every email you send. And remember, even Facebook. To tweet and to express your fundamental beliefs and dreams. Affirm to others the vision of the world you want. Network through thought. Network through action. Network through love. Network through the spirit. You are the center of a network. You are the center of the world. You are a free, immensely powerful source of life and goodness. Affirm it, spread it, radiate it. Think day and night about it, and you will see a miracle happen. The greatness of your own life in a world of big powers, media and monopolies. But of 7.7 billion individuals, networking is the new freedom, the new democracy, a new transparency, and a new form of wholeness and happiness. This originated by Dr. Robert Muller, Chancellor of the World Peace University in Costa Rica, Central America. I invite you to be able to come to greenplanetfm.com, where we have over 400 interviews in our database, which you can readily download and listen to be able to inspire yourself to become the change you want to see in the world. And become involved in caring for your children and grandchildren's future. We are also on Facebook, on Green Planet FM, and ourplanet.org. Please come and love us. This is Tim Lynch.
And Lisa Eyre.
And Liz Gunn.
In the spirit of Aroha, wishing you a wonderful week. We look forward to being with you next week. I say, Kia Kaha and Haere Ra.